Chapter 14. He had slept about 2 hours when the daylight woke him, and he looked at Catherine sleeping easily and looking happy in her sleep. He left her looking beautiful and young and unspoiled, and then went into the bathroom and showered and put on a pair of shorts, and walked barefoot through the garden to the room where he worked. The sky was washed clean after the wind, and it was the fresh early morning of a new day toward the end of summer. He started in again on the new and difficult story and worked, attacking each thing that for years he had put off facing. He worked until nearly 11 o'clock, and when he had finished for the day, he shut up the room and went out and found the two girls playing chess at a table in the garden. They both looked fresh and young and as attractive as the wind-washed morning sky.
"She's beating me again," Catherine said. "How are you, David?"
The girl smiled at him very shyly. "They are the two loveliest girls I've ever seen," David thought. "Now what will this day bring?" "How are you two?" he said.
"We're very well," the girl said. "Did you have good luck?"
"It's all uphill, but it's going well," he said.
"You haven't had any breakfast?"
"It's too late for breakfast," David said.
"Nonsense," Catherine said. "Your wife of the day, Eris. Make him eat breakfast." "Wouldn't you like coffee and some fruit, David?" the girl asked. "You ought to eat something."
"I'll have some black coffee," David said.
"I'll bring you something," the girl said, and went off into the hotel.
David sat by Catherine at the table, and she put the chessmen and the board on a chair. She mussed his hair and said,
"Have you forgotten you have a silver head like mine?"
"Yes," he said.
"It's going to be lighter and lighter, and I'll be fairer and fairer and darker in the body, too."
"That will be wonderful."
"Yes, and I'm all over everything."
The pretty dark girl was bringing a tray with a small bowl rounded with caviar, a half lemon, a spoon, and 2 pieces of toast, and the young waiter had a bucket with a bottle of the Bollinger and a tray with 3 glasses.
"This will be good for David," the girl said. "Then we can go swimming before lunch."
After the swimming and the lying in the sun on the beach and a big long lunch with more of the Bollinger, Catherine said,
"I'm really tired and sleepy."
"You swam a long way," David said.
"We'll make a siesta." "I want to really sleep," Catherine said. "Do you feel well, Catherine?" the girl asked. "Yes, just deadly sleepy."
"We'll put you to bed," David said.
"Do you have a thermometer?" he asked the girl.
"I'm sure I haven't any fever," Catherine said.
"I just want to sleep for a long time."
When she was in bed, the girl brought in a thermometer, and David took Catherine's temperature and her pulse. The temperature was normal, and the pulse was 105.
"The pulse is a little high," he said, "but I don't know your normal pulse." "I don't either, but it's probably too fast."
"I don't think the pulse means much with the temperature normal," David said. "But if you have a fever, I'll bring a doctor up from Khan."
"I don't want a doctor," Catherine said. "I just want to sleep. Can I sleep now?"
"Yes, my beauty. You call if you want me." They stood and watched her go to sleep, and then went out very quietly, and David walked along the stones and looked through the window. Catherine was sleeping quietly, and her breathing was regular. He brought 2 chairs up and a table, and they sat in the shade near Catherine's window and looked out through the pines to the blue sea.
"What do you think?" David asked. "I don't know. She was happy this morning, just as you saw her when you finished writing."
"What about now?"
"Maybe just a reaction from yesterday. She's a very natural girl, David, and this is natural."
"Yesterday was like loving someone when someone's died," he said. "It wasn't right." He stood up and walked to the window and looked in. Catherine was sleeping in the same position and breathing lightly.
"She's sleeping well," he told the girl.
"Wouldn't you like to take a nap?"
"I think so."
"I'm going down to my room where I work," he said. "There's a door to yours that bolts on each side." He walked down along the stones and unlocked the door of his room and then unbolted the door between the 2 rooms. He stood and waited, and then heard the bolt turn on the other side of the door, and then the door opened. They sat side by side on the bed, and he put his arm around her.
"Kiss me," David said. I love to kiss you, she said. I love it so very much. But I can't do the other.
No?
No, I can't.
Then she said,
Isn't there anything I can do for you now? I'm so ashamed about the other, but you know how it could make trouble.
Just lie here by me.
I'd love that.
Do what you like.
I will, she said. You too, please. Do what we can.
Catherine slept all through the afternoon and early evening. David and the girl were sitting at the bar having a drink together, and the girl said,
They never did bring the mirror.
Did you ask the old man Aurol about it?
Yes, he was pleased.
I'd better pay him corkage on that Bollinger or something.
I gave him 4 bottles and 2 very good bottles of Fine. He's taken care of. It was Madame I was afraid of about trouble.
You are absolutely right.
I don't want to make trouble, David.
No, he said. I don't think you do. The young waiter had come in with more ice, and David made 2 martinis and gave her 1. The waiter put in the garlic olives and then went back to the kitchen.
I'll go and see how Catherine is, the girl said. Things will turn out or they won't.
She was gone for about 10 minutes, and he felt of the girl's drink and decided to drink it before it got warm. He took it in his hand and raised it to his lips, and he found as it touched his lips that it gave him pleasure because it was hers. It was clear and undeniable. That's all you need, he thought. That's all you need to make things really perfect. Be in love with both of them. What's happened to you since last May? What are you anymore, anyway? But he touched the glass to his lips again, and there was the same reaction as before. All right, he said. Remember to do the work. The work is what you have left. You better fork up with the work. The girl came back, and when he saw her come in, her face happy, he knew how he felt about her.
She's getting dressed, the girl said. She feels fine. Isn't it wonderful?
Yes, he said, loving Catherine too, as always.
What happened to my drink?
I drank it, he said, because it was yours.
Truly, David?
She blushed and was happy. That's as well as I can put it, he said. Here's a new one. She tasted it and passed her lips very lightly over the rim, and then passed it to him, and he did the same and took a long sip. You're very beautiful, he said, and I love you. Chapter 15. He heard the Bugatti start, and the noise came as a surprise and an intrusion because there was no motor noise in the country where he was living. He was completely detached from everything except the story he was writing, and he was living in it as he built it. The difficult parts he had dreaded he now faced one after another, and as he did, the people, the country, the days and the nights, and the weather were all there as he wrote. He went on working, and he felt as tired as if he had spent the night crossing the broken volcanic desert, and the sun had caught him and the others with the dry, gray lake still ahead. He could feel the weight of the heavy, double-barreled rifle carried over his shoulder, his hand on the muzzle, and he tasted the pebble in his mouth. Across the shimmer of the dry lakes, he could see the distant blue of the escarpment. Ahead of him there was no one, and behind was the long line of porters who knew that they had reached this point 3 hours too late. It was not him, of course, who had stood there that morning, nor had he even worn the patched corduroy jacket, faded almost white now, the armpits rotted through by sweat, that he took off then and handed to his Kamba servant and brother who shared with him the guilt and knowledge of the delay, watching him smell the sour, vinegary smell and shake his head in disgust, and then grin as he swung the jacket over his black shoulder, holding it by the sleeves as they started off across the dry-baked gray, the gun muzzles in their right hands, the barrels balanced on their shoulders, the heavy stocks pointing back toward the line of porters. It was not him, but as he wrote, it was, and when someone read it, finally it would be whoever read it, and what they found when they should reach the escarpment, if they reached it. And he would make them reach its base by noon of that day. Then whoever read it would find what there was there and have it always. All your father found, he found for you too, he thought. The good, the wonderful, the bad, the very bad, the really very bad, the truly bad, and then the much worse.
It was a shame a man with such a talent for disaster and for delight should have gone the way he went, he thought. It always made him happy to remember his father, and he knew his father would have liked this story. It was nearly noon when he came out of the room and walked barefoot on the stones of the patio to the entrance of the hotel. In the big room, workmen were putting up a mirror on the wall behind the bar. Monsieur Aurore and the young waiter were with them, and he spoke to them and went out in the kitchen where he found Madame. "Have you any beer, Madame?" he asked her. "Mais certainement, Monsieur Bourne," she said, and brought a cold bottle from the ice chest. "I'll drink it from the bottle," he said.
"As Monsieur wishes," she said. "The ladies drove to Nice, I believe. Monsieur worked well?"
"Very well."
"Monsieur works too hard. It's not good not to take breakfast."
"Is there any of that caviar left in the tin?"
"I'm sure there is."
"I'll take a couple of spoons full."
"Monsieur is odd," Madame said. "Yesterday you ate it with champagne, today with beer."
"I'm alone today," David said.
"Do you know if my bicyclette is still in the remise?"
"It should be," Madame said. David took a spoonful of the caviar and offered the tin to Madame. "Have some, Madame. It's very good."
"I shouldn't," she said.
"Don't be silly," he told her. "Take some. There's some toast. Take a glass of champagne. There's some in the icebox." Madame took a spoonful of caviar and put it on a piece of toast left from breakfast and poured herself a glass of rosé.
"It is excellent," she said. "Now we must put it away."
"Do you feel any good effect?" David asked.
"I'm going to have one more spoon." "Ah, monsieur, you mustn't joke like that."
"Why not?" David said. "My joking partners are away. If those two beautiful women come back, tell them I went for a swim, will you?"
"Certainly. The little one is a beauty.
Not as beautiful as Madame, of course." "I find her not too ugly," David said.
"She's a beauty, monsieur, and very charming."
"She'll do until something else comes along," David said. "If you think she's pretty." "Monsieur," she said in deepest reproof. "What are all the architectural reforms?" David asked.
"The new mirror for the bar. It's such a charming gift to the maison."
"Everyone's full of charm," David said. "Charm and sturgeon eggs. Ask the boy to look at my tires while I put something on my feet and find a cap, will you please?"
"Monsieur likes to go barefoot." "Me too, in summer."
"We'll go barefoot together sometime." "Monsieur," she said, giving it everything. "Is Aurore jealous?"
"Sans blague," she said. "I'll tell the two beautiful ladies you've gone swimming."
"Keep the caviar away from Aurore," David said.
"A bientôt, chère madame." "A tout à l'heure, monsieur."
On the shiny black road that mounted through the pines as he left the hotel, he felt the pull in his arms and his shoulders, and the rounding thrust of his feet against the pedals as he climbed in the hot sun with the smell of the pines and the light breeze that came from the sea. He bent his back forward and pulled lightly against his hands and felt the cadence that had been ragged as he first mounted begin to smooth out as he passed the 100-meter stones and then the first red-topped kilometer marker and then the second. At the headland, the road dipped to border the sea and he braked and dismounted and put the bicycle over his shoulder and walked down with it along the trail to the beach. He propped it against a pine tree that gave off the resin smell of the hot day, and he dropped down to the rocks, stripped, and put his espadrilles on his shorts, shirt, and cap, and he dove from the rocks into the deep, clear, cold sea. He came up through the varying light, and when his head came out, he shook it to clear his ears and then swam out to sea. He lay on his back and floated, and watched the sky and the first white clouds that were coming with the breeze. He swam back into the cove finally and climbed up on the dark red rocks and sat there in the sun, looking down into the sea. He was happy to be alone and to have finished his work for the day. Then the loneliness he always had after work started, and he began to think about the girls and to miss them. Not to miss the one nor the other at first, but to miss them both. Then he thought of them, not critically, not as any problem of love or fondness, nor of an obligation, nor of what had happened or would happen, nor of any problem of conduct now or to come, but simply of how he missed them. He was lonely for them both, alone and together,
and he wanted them both. Sitting in the sun on the rock looking down into the sea, he knew it was wrong to want them both, but he did. Nothing with either of those two can end well, and neither can you now, he told himself. But do not start blaming who you love, nor apportioning blame. It will all be apportioned in due time, and not by you. He looked down into the sea and tried to think clearly what the situation was, and it did not work out. The worst was what had happened to Catherine. The next worst was that he had begun to care for the other girl. He did not have to examine his conscience to know that he loved Catherine, nor that it was wrong to love two women, and that no good could ever come of it. He did not yet know how terrible it could be. He only knew that it had started. The three of you are already enmeshed like three gears that turn a wheel, he told himself. And also told himself one gear had been stripped, or at least badly damaged. He dove deep down into the clear, cold water where he missed no one, and then came up and shook his head and swam out further, and then turned to swim back to the beach. He dressed, still wet from the sea, and put his cap in his pocket, then climbed up to the road with his bicycle and mounted, driving the machine up the short hill, feeling the lack of training in his thighs as he pressed the balls of his feet on the pedals with the steady climbing thrust that carried him up the black road, as though he and the racing bike were some wheeled animal. Then he coasted down, his hands fingering the brakes, taking the curves fast, dropping down the shiny dark road through the pines, to the turnoff at the back court of the hotel, where the sea shone summer blue beyond the trees. The girls were not back yet, and he went into the room and took a shower, changed to a fresh shirt and shorts, and came out to the bar with its new and handsome mirror. He called the boy and asked him to bring a lemon, a knife, and some ice, and showed him how to make a Tom Collins. Then he sat on the bar stool and looked into the mirror as he lifted the tall drink. I don't know if I'd have a drink with you or not if I'd met you 4 months ago, he thought. The boy brought him the Éclaireur de Nice, and he read it while he waited. He had been disappointed not to find the girls returned, and he missed them and began to worry. When they came in, finally, Catherine was very gay and excited, and the girl was contrite and very quiet. Hello, darling, Catherine said to David. Oh, look at the mirror. They did get it up. It's a very good one, too. It's awfully critical, though. I'll go in and clean up for lunch. I'm sorry we're late. We stopped in town and had a drink, the girl said to David. I'm sorry to have kept you waiting. A drink? David said. The girl held up two fingers. She put her face up and kissed him and was gone. David went back to reading the paper. When Catherine came out, she was wearing the dark blue linen shirt that David liked and slacks, and she said, Darling, I hope you're not cross. It wasn't really our fault. I saw Jean and asked him to have a drink with us, and he did and was so nice.
The coiffeur?
Jean, of course. What other Jean would I know in Cannes? He was so nice, and he asked about you. Can I have a martini, darling? I've only had one.
Lunch must be ready by now.
Just one, darling. They only have us for lunch.
David made two martinis, taking his time, and the girl came in. She was wearing a white shark-skin dress, and she looked fresh and cool.
May I have one too, David? It was a very hot day. How was it here?
You should have stayed home and looked after him, Catherine said.
I got along all right, David said. The sea was very good.
You use such interesting adjectives, Catherine said.
They make everything so vivid.
Sorry, David said.
That's another dandy word, Catherine said. Explain what dandy means to your new girl.
It's an Americanism.
I think I know it, the girl said. It's the third word in Yankee Doodle Dandy. Don't please be cross, Catherine.
I'm not cross, Catherine said. But 2 days ago when you made passes at me, it was simply dandy. But today, if I felt that way the slightest bit, you had to act as though I was an I don't know what.
I'm sorry, Catherine, the girl said.
Another sorry, Catherine said, as though you hadn't taught me what little I know.
Should we have lunch? David said. It's been a hot day, devil, and you're tired.
I'm tired of everybody, Catherine said. Please forgive me.
There's nothing to forgive, the girl said. I'm sorry I was stuffy. I didn't come here to be that way.
She walked over to Catherine and kissed her very gently and lightly.
Now be a good girl, she said. Should we go to the table?
Didn't we have lunch? Catherine asked.
No, devil, David said. We're going to have lunch now. At the end of lunch, Catherine, who had made sense through all of it, except for some absent-mindedness, said,
Please excuse me, but I think I ought to sleep.
Let me come with you and see you get to sleep, the girl said.
Actually, I think I drank too much, Catherine said.
I'll come in and take a nap too, David said.
No, please, David. Come in when I'm asleep if you want, Catherine said.
In about half an hour, the girl came out of the room.
She's all right, she said, but we must be careful and good with her and only think about her.
In the room, Catherine was awake when David came in, and he went over and sat on the bed.
I'm not a damned invalid, she said. I just drank too much. I know I'm sorry I lied to you about it. How could I do that, David?
You didn't remember?
No, I did it on purpose. Will you take me back? I'm over all the bitchiness.
You never were away.
If you take me back is all I want, I'll be your really true girl and really, truly be. Would you like that?
He kissed her.
Really kiss me. Oh, she said. Please be slow.
They swam at the cove where they had gone the first day. David had planned to send the two girls to swim, and then to take the old Asada down to Khan to have the brakes fixed and the ignition overhauled. But Catherine had asked him to please swim with them and to do the car the next day, and she seemed so happy and sound and cheerful again after her nap, and Marita had said very seriously, Will you please come? So he had driven them to the turnout for the cove and shown them both on the way how dangerously the brakes were working. You'd kill yourself with this car, he told Marita. It's a crime to drive it the way it is.
Had I ought to get a new one? She asked.
Christ, no. Just let me fix the brakes to start with.
We need a larger car with room for all of us, Catherine said.
This is a fine car, David said. It just needs a hell of a lot of work done on it. But it's too much car for you.
You see if they can fix it properly, the girl said. If they can't, we'll get the type of car you want.
Then they were tanning on the beach, and David said lazily, Come in and swim.
Pour some water on my head, Catherine said. I brought a sand bucket in the rucksack.
Oh, that feels wonderful, she said.
Could I have one more? Pour it on my face, too.
She lay on the hard beach on her white robe in the sun, and David and the girl swam out to sea and around the rocks at the mouth of the cove. The girl was swimming ahead, and David overhauled her. He reached out and grabbed a foot and then held her close in his arms and kissed her as they treaded water. She felt slippery and strange in the water, and they seemed the same height as they treaded water with their bodies close together and kissed. Then her head went under and he leaned back and she came up laughing and shaking her head that was sleek as a seal, and she brought her lips against his again, and they kissed until they both went under. They lay side by side and floated and touched and then kissed hard and happily and went under again.
I don't worry about anything now, she said, when they came up again. You mustn't either.
I won't, he said, and they swam in.
You better go in, devil, he said to Catherine. Your head will get too hot.
All right, let's go in, she said. Let Eris darken now. Let me put some oil on her.
Not too much, the girl said. May I have a pail of water on my head, too?
Your head's as wet as it can get, Catherine said.
I just wanted to feel it, the girl said.
Wait out, David, and get a good cold one, Catherine said.
And after he had poured the clear, cool sea on Marita's head, they left her lying with her face on her arms and swam out to sea. They floated easily like sea animals, and Catherine said,
Wouldn't it be wonderful if I wasn't crazy?
You're not crazy.
Not this afternoon, she said. Anyway, not so far. Can we swim further?
We're pretty well out, devil.
All right, let's swim back in. But the deep water's beautiful out here.
Do you want to swim down once before we go in?
Just once, she said, in this very deep part.
We'll swim down until we can just make it up. Chapter 16 He woke when it was barely just light enough to see the pine trunks, and he left the bed, careful not to wake Catherine, found his shorts and went, the soles of his feet wet from the dew on the stones, along the length of the hotel to the door of his workroom. As he opened the door, he felt again the touch of the air from the sea that promised how the day would be. When he sat down, the sun was not yet up, and he felt that he had made up some of the time that was lost in the story. But as he reread his careful, legible hand, and the words took him away and into the other country, he lost that advantage and was faced with the same problem. And when the sun rose out of the sea, it had, for him, risen long before, and he was well into the crossing of the gray, dried, bitter lakes, his boots now white with crusted alkalis. He felt the weight of the sun on his head and his neck and his back. His shirt was wet, and he felt the sweat go down his back and between his thighs. When he stood straight up and rested, breathing slowly, and his shirt hung away from his shoulders, he could feel it dry in the sun and see the white patches that the salts of his body made in the drying. He could feel and see himself standing there, and he knew there was nothing to do except go on. At 10:30 he had crossed the lakes and was well beyond them. By then he had reached the river and the great grove of fig trees where they would make their camp. The bark of the trunks was green and yellow and the branches were heavy. Baboons had been eating the wild figs and there were baboon droppings and broken figs on the ground. The smell was foul. But the 10:30 was on the watch on his wrist as he looked at it in the room where he sat at a table, feeling the breeze from the sea now. And the real time was evening, and he was sitting against the yellow-gray base of a tree with a glass of whiskey and water in his hand, and the rolled figs swept away, watching the porters butchering out the congoni he had shot in the first grassy swale they passed before they came to the river. "I'll leave them with meat," he thought. "And so it is a happy camp tonight, no matter what comes after." So he put his pencils and the notebooks away and locked the suitcase and went out the door and walked on the stones, dry and warm now, to the hotel patio. The girl was sitting at one of the tables reading a book. She wore a striped fisherman's shirt and tennis skirt and espadrilles, and when she saw him, she looked up. And David thought she was going to blush, but she seemed to check it and said,
"Good morning, David. Did you work well?"
"Yes, beauty," he said. She stood up then and kissed him good morning and said, "I'm very happy then. Catherine went into Cannes. She said to tell you I was to take you swimming." "Didn't she want you to go in town with her?"
"No, she wanted me to stay. She said you got up terribly early to work and maybe you'd be lonely when you finished. Can I order some breakfast? You shouldn't always not eat breakfast."
The girl went into the kitchen and she came out with œufs au plat avec jambon and English mustard and savora.
"Was it difficult today?" she asked him.
"No," he said. "It's always difficult, but it's easy too. It went very well."
"I wish I could help."
"Nobody can help," he said.
"But I can help in other things, can't I?"
He started to say there are no other things, but he did not say it, and instead he said, "You have and you do." He wiped the last of the egg and mustard up from the shallow dish with a small piece of bread and then drank some tea. "How did you sleep?" he asked.
"Very well," the girl said. "I hope that's not disloyal."
"No, that's intelligent."
"Can we stop being so polite?" the girl asked. "Everything was so simple and fine until now."
"Yes, let's stop. Let's stop even the I can't, David, nonsense," he said.
"All right," she said, and stood up. "If you want to go swimming, I'll be in my room."
He stood up. "Please don't go," he said. "I've stopped being a shit."
"Don't stop for me," she said. "Oh, David, how could we ever get in a thing like this? Poor David. What women do to you."
She was stroking his head and smiling at him.
"I'll get the swimming things if you want to swim."
"Good," he said. "I'll go get my espadrilles." They lay on the sand where David had spread the beach robes and the towels in the shade of a red rock, and the girl said,
"You go in and swim, and then I will."
He lifted very slowly and gently up out and away from her, and then waded out from the beach and dove under where the water was cold and swam deep. When he came up, he swam out against the chop of the breeze and then swam in to where the girl was waiting for him. Standing up to her waist in the water, her black head sleek and wet, her light brown body dripping. He held her tight, and the waves washed against them. They kissed, and she said,
"Everything of ours washed into the ocean. We have to get back. Let's go under once, together holding tight."
Back at the hotel, Catherine had not arrived, and after they had taken showers and changed, David and Marita sat at the bar with two martinis. They looked at each other in the mirror. They watched each other very carefully, and then David passed his finger under his nose while he looked at her and she blushed.
"I want to have more things like that," she said. "Things that only we have, so I won't be jealous."
"I wouldn't put out too many anchors," he said. "You might foul the cables."
"No, I'll find things to do that will hold you."
"That's a good practical heiress," he said.
"I wish I could change that name, don't you?"
"Names go to the bone," he said.
"Then let's really change mine," she said. "Would you mind terribly?"
"No."
"Haya." "Say it again, please."
"Haya."
"Is it good?"
"Very good. It's a small name between us, for nobody else ever."
"What does Haya mean?"
"The one who blushes. The modest one." He held her close and tight, and she settled against him, and her head was on his shoulder.
"Kiss me just once," she said.
Catherine came into the big room disheveled, excited, and full of accomplishment and gaiety.
"You did take him swimming," she said. "You both do look handsome enough, though still wet from the shower. Let me look at you."
"Let me look at you," the girl said. "What did you do to your hair?"
"It's cendre," Catherine said. "Do you like it? It's a rinse that Jean's experimenting with."
"It's beautiful," the girl said.
Catherine's hair was strange and exalting against her dark face. She picked up Marita's drink and, sipping it, watched herself in the mirror and said,
"Did you have fun swimming?"
"We both had a good swim," the girl said. "But not as long as yesterday."
"This is such a good drink, David," Catherine said. "What makes your martinis better than anyone else's?"
"Gin," David said.
"Will you make me one, please?"
"You don't want one now, devil. We're going to have lunch."
"Yes, I do," she said. "I'm going to sleep after lunch."
"You didn't have to go through all the bleaching and re-bleaching and all of it. It's exhausting."
"What color is your hair really now?" David asked.
"It's almost like white," she said. "You'd like it. But I want to keep this so we see how it lasts."
"How white is it?" David asked.
"About like the soap suds," she said. "Do you remember?" That evening, Catherine was completely different from the way she had been at midday. She was sitting at the bar when they drove up from swimming. The girl had stopped off at her room, and when David came into the big main room, he said, "What have you done to yourself now, devil?"
"I shampooed all that nonsense out," she said. "It made gray stains on the pillow."
She looked very striking, her hair a very light, almost toneless silver that made her face darker than it had ever looked.
"You're too damn beautiful," he said.
"But I wish they'd never touched your hair."
"It's too late for that now. Can I tell you something else?"
"Sure."
"Tomorrow I'm not going to have drinks, and I'm going to study Spanish and read again and stop thinking only about myself."
"My God," David said, "you had a big day. Here, let me get a drink and go in and change."
"I'll be here," Catherine said. "Put on your dark blue shirt, will you? The one I got you, like the one of mine?"
David took his time in the shower and changing, and when he came back, the two girls were together at the bar, and he wished he could have a painting of them.
"I told Eris everything about my new leaf," Catherine said, "the one I just turned over, and how I want you to love her too, and you can marry her too if she'll have you."
"We could in Africa if I was registered Mohammedan. You're allowed 3 wives.
"I think it would be much nicer if we were all married," Catherine said. "Then no one would criticize us."
"Will you really marry him, Eris?"
"Yes," the girl said. "I'm so pleased," Catherine said. "Everything I worried about is so simple now."
"Would you really?" David asked the dark girl.
Yes, she said. Ask me.
David looked at her. She was very serious and excited. He thought of her face with her eyes closed against the sun and her black head against the whiteness of the towel robe on the yellow sand as it had been when they had made love at last.
I'll ask you, he said, but not in any damn bar.
This isn't any damned bar, Catherine said.
This is our own special bar, and we brought the mirror. I wish we could marry you tonight.
Don't talk balls, David said.
I'm not, Catherine said. I really mean it, truly.
Do you want a drink? David asked.
No, Catherine said. I want to get it set right first. Look at me and see.
The girl was looking down, and David looked at Catherine.
I thought it all out this afternoon, she said. I really did. Didn't I tell you, Marita?
She did, the girl said. David saw that she was serious about this, and that they had reached some understanding that he did not know about.
I'm still your wife, Catherine said. We'll start with that. I want Marita to be your wife, too, to help me out, and then she inherits from me.
Why does she have to inherit?
People make their wills, she said, and this is more important than a will.
What about you? David asked the girl.
I want to do it if you want me to.
Good, he said. Do you mind if I have a drink?
You have one, please, Catherine said. You see, I'm not going to have you ruined if I'm crazy and I won't be able to decide. I'm not going to be shut up either. I decided that too. She loves you and you love her a little, I can tell. You'd never find anybody else like her, and I don't want you to go to some damn bitch or be lonely.
Come on and cheer up, David said. You're healthy as a goat.
Well, we're going to do it, Catherine said. We'll work out everything.
Chapter 17. The sun was bright now in the room, and it was a new day. You better get to work, he told himself. You can't change any of it back. Only one person can change it back, and she can't know how she will wake, nor if she'll be there when she wakes. It doesn't matter how you feel. You better get to work. You have to make sense there. You don't make any in this other. Nothing will help you, nor would have ever since it started. When he finally got back into the story, the sun was well up, and he had forgotten the two girls. It had been necessary to think what his father would have thought sitting that evening with his back against the green-yellow trunk of the fig tree with the enameled cup of whiskey and water in his hand. His father had dealt so lightly with evil, giving it no chance ever and denying its importance so that it had no status and no shape nor dignity. He treated evil like an old entrusted friend, David thought, and evil, when she poxed him, never knew she'd scored. His father was not vulnerable, he knew, and, unlike most people he had known, only death could kill him. Finally, he knew what his father had thought, and knowing it, he did not put it in the story. He only wrote what his father did, and how he felt, and in all this he became his father, and what his father said to Moto was what he said. He slept well on the ground under the tree, and he waked and heard the leopard cough. Later he did not hear the leopard in the camp, but he knew he was there, and he went back to sleep. The leopard was after meat, and there was plenty of meat, so there was no problem. In the morning, before daylight, sitting by the ashes of the fire with his tea in the chipped enameled cup, he asked Moto if the leopard had taken meat, and Moto said,
"Ndio," and he said, "There's plenty where we're going. Get them moving so we can start the climb."
They were moving for the second day through the high wooded and park-like country above the escarpment when he stopped finally, and he was happy with the country and the day and the distance they had made. He had his father's ability to forget now and not dread anything that was coming. There was another day and another night ahead in that new high country when he stopped, and he had lived 2 days and a night today. Now that he left that country, his father was with him still as he locked the door and walked back to the big room in the bar. He told the boy he did not want breakfast and to bring him a whiskey and Perrier in the morning paper. It was past noon and he had intended to drive the old Asada into Cannes and see that the repairs were made, but he knew the garages were closed now and it was too late. Instead, he stood at the bar because that's where he would have found his father at that hour, and, having just come down from the high country, he missed him. The sky outside was very much the sky that he had left. It was high blue and the clouds white cumulus, and he welcomed his father's presence at the bar until he glanced in the mirror and saw he was alone. He had intended to ask his father about two things. His father, who ran his life more disastrously than any man that he had ever known, gave marvelous advice. He distilled it out of the bitter mash of all his previous mistakes, with the freshening addition of the new mistakes he was about to make, and he gave it with an accuracy and precision that carried the authority of a man who had heard all the more grisly provisions of his sentence and gave it no more importance than he had given to the fine print on a transatlantic steamship ticket. He was sorry that his father had not stayed, but he could hear the advice clearly enough, and he smiled. His father would have given it more exactly, but he, David, had stopped writing because he was tired, and, tired, he could not do justice to his father's style. No one could, really. And sometimes his father could not either. He knew now, more than ever, why he had always put off writing this story, and he knew he must not think about it now that he had left it, or he would damage his ability to write it. "You must not worry about it before you start, nor when you stop," he told himself. "You're lucky to have it, and don't start fumbling with it now. If you cannot respect the way you handle your life, then certainly respect your trade. You know about your trade, at least." But it was a rather awful story, really. By God, it was. He sipped the whiskey and Perrier again and looked out the door at the late summer day. He was cooling out, as he always did, and the giant killer made things better. He wondered where the girls were. They were late again, and he hoped that this time it would be nothing bad. He was not a tragic character. Having his father and being a writer barred him from that. And as he finished the whiskey and Perrier, he felt even less of one. He had never known a morning when he had not waked happily until the enormity of the day had touched him, and he had accepted this day now as he accepted all the others for himself. He had lost the capacity of personal suffering, or he thought he had, and only could be hurt truly by what happened to others. He believed this, wrongly of course, since he did not know then how one's capacities can change, nor how the other could change, and it was a comfortable belief. He thought of the two girls and wished that they would turn up. It was getting too late to swim before lunch, but he wanted to see them. He thought about them both. Then he went into his and Catherine's room and took a shower and shaved. He was shaving when he heard the car come up, and he felt the sudden empty feeling in his gut. Then he heard their voices and heard them laughing, and he found a fresh pair of shorts and a shirt and pulled them on and went out to see how things would be. The three of them had quiet drinks and then a lunch that was good but light, and they drank Tavel, and when they were eating cheese and fruit, Catherine said, "Should I tell him?" "If you want," the girl said. She picked up her wine and drank part of it down. "I forgot how to say it," Catherine said. "We waited too long." "Can't you remember it?" the girl said. "No, I've forgotten it, and it was wonderful. We had it all worked out, and it was really wonderful." David poured himself another glass of Tavel. "Do you want to try for just the factual content?" he asked. "I know the factual content," Catherine said. "It's that yesterday you made siesta with me, and then you went to Marita's room, but today you can just go there. But I've spoiled it now, and what I wish is we could all just make siesta together." "Not siesta," David heard himself say. "I suppose not," Catherine said. "Well, I'm sorry I said it all wrong, and I couldn't help saying what I wished." In the room, he said to Catherine, "To hell with her." "No, David, she wanted to do what I asked her. Maybe she can tell you." "Fuck her." "Well, you have," she said. "That's not the point. Go and talk with her, David. And if you want to fuck her, then fuck her good for me."
"Don't talk rough."
"You used it. I just knocked it back, like tennis."
"All right," David said. "What's she supposed to say to me?"
"My speech," Catherine said. "The one I forgot. Don't look so serious or I won't let you go. You're awfully appealing when you're serious.
You better go before she forgets the speech.
The hell with you too.
That's good. Now you're reacting better. I like you when you are more careless. Kiss me goodbye. Good afternoon. You really better go or she will forget the speech. Don't you see how reasonable and good I am?
You're not reasonable and good.
You like me, though.
Sure.
Do you want me to tell you a secret?
A new one?
An old one.
All right.
You aren't very hard to corrupt, and you're an awful lot of fun to corrupt.
You ought to know.
It was just a joke secret. There isn't any corruption. We just have fun. Go on in and have her make my speech before she forgets it, too. Go on and be a good boy, David.
In the room at the far end of the hotel, David lay on the bed and said, "What's it all about, really?"
"It's just what she said last night," the girl said. "She really means it. You don't know how much she means it."
"Did you tell her we'd made love?"
"No."
"She knew it."
"Does it matter?"
"It didn't seem to."
"Take a glass of wine, David, and be comfortable. I'm not indifferent," she said. "I hope you know that."
"I'm not either," he said. Then their lips were together, and he felt her body against his, and her breasts against his chest, and her lips tight against his and then open, her head moving from side to side, and her breathing, and the feel of his belt buckle against his belly and in his hands. They lay on the beach, and David watched the sky and the movement of the clouds and did not think at all. Thinking did no good, and when he lay down, he had thought that if he did not think, then everything that was wrong might go away. The girls were talking, but he did not listen to them. He lay and watched the September sky, and when the girls had fallen silent, he started to think, and without looking at the girl, he asked, "What are you thinking?"
"Nothing," she said.
"Ask me," Catherine said.
"I can guess what you're thinking."
"No, you can't. I was thinking about the Prado."
"Have you been there?" David asked the girl.
"Not yet," she said.
"We'll go," Catherine said.
"When can we go, David?"
"Anytime," David said.
"I want to finish the story first."
"Will you work hard on the story?"
"That's what I'm doing. I can't work any harder."
"I didn't mean to hurry it."
"I won't," he said. "If you're getting bored here, you two go on ahead and I'll find you there."
"I don't want to do that," Marita said.
"Don't be silly," Catherine said. "He's just being noble."
"No, you can go."
"It wouldn't be any fun without you," Catherine said. "You know that. We two in Spain wouldn't be fun."
"He's working, Catherine," Marita said.
"He could work in Spain," Catherine said. "Plenty of Spanish writers must have worked in Spain. I'll bet I could write well in Spain if I was a writer."
"I can write in Spain," David said. "When do you want to go?"
"Damn you, Catherine," Marita said. "He's in the middle of a story."
"He's been writing for over 6 weeks," Catherine said.
"Why can't we go to Madrid?"
"I said we could," David said.
"Don't you dare do that," the girl said to Catherine. "Don't you dare to try to do that. Haven't you any conscience at all?"
"You're a fine one to talk about conscience," Catherine said.
"I have a conscience about some things." "That's fine. I'm happy to know it. Now will you try to be polite and not interfere when someone is trying to work out what's best for everyone?"
"I'm going to swim," David said.
The girl got up and followed him, and outside the cove while they treaded water, she said,
"She's crazy."
"So don't blame her."
"But what are you going to do?"
"Finish the story and start another."
"So what do you and I do?"
"What we can."
Chapter 18. He finished the story in 4 days. He had in it all the pressure that had built while he was writing it, and the modest part of him was afraid that it could not possibly be as good as he believed it to be. The cold, hard part knew it was better.
"How was it today?" the girl asked him.
"I finished."
"Can I read it?"
"If you want to."
"You wouldn't mind, truly?"
"It's in those 2 cahiers in the top of the suitcase." He handed her the key and then sat at the bar and drank a whiskey and Perrier and read the morning paper.
She came back and sat on a stool a little way down from him and read the story. When she finished it, she started to read it over again, and he made himself a second whiskey and soda and watched her read. When she finished it the second time, he said, "Do you like it?"
"It's not a thing you like or not like," she said. "It's your father, isn't it?"
"Sure."
"Was this when you stopped loving him?"
"No, I always loved him. This was when I got to know him."
"It's a terrible story, and it's wonderful."
"I'm glad you like it," he said.
"I'll put it back now," she said. "I like going in the room when the door is locked."
"We have that," David said. When they came back from the beach, they found Catherine in the garden. "So you got back," she said. "Yes," David said. "We had a good swim. I wish you'd been there."
"Well, I wasn't," she said.
"If it's of any interest to you." "Where did you go?" David asked.
"I was in Cannes on my own business," she said. "You're both late for lunch."
"I'm sorry," David said. "Do you want to have anything before lunch?"
"Please excuse me, Catherine," Marita said. "I'll be back in a moment."
"You're still drinking before lunch?" Catherine asked David.
"Yes," he said.
"I don't think it matters if you're getting a lot of exercise."
"There was an empty whiskey glass in the bar when I came in."
"Yes," said David. "I had two whiskeys, actually."
"Actually," she mimicked him. "You're very British today."
"Really?" he said. "I didn't feel very British. I felt sort of half-assed Tahitian."
"It's just your way of speaking that irritates me," she said. "Your choice of words."
"I see," he said. "Do you want a shot before they bring the chow?"
"You don't have to be a clown."
"The best clowns don't talk," he said.
"Nobody accused you of being the best of clowns," she said. "Yes, I'd like a drink if it isn't too much work for you to make it."
He made three martinis, measuring them out separately and pouring them into the pitcher where there was a big chunk of ice and then stirring.
"Who's the third drink for?"
"Marita."
"Your paramour?"
"My what?"
"Your paramour."
"You really said it," David told her. "I've never heard that word pronounced, and I had absolutely no hope of ever hearing it in this life. You're really wonderful."
"It's a perfectly common word."
"It is at that," David said. "But to have the sheer, naked courage to use it in conversation, devil, be good now. Couldn't you say you're a dusky paramour?" Catherine looked away as she raised her glass.
"And I used to find this type of banter amusing," she said.
"Do you want to try to be decent?" David asked. "Both of us decent?"
"No," she said. "Here comes whatever you call her, looking sweet and innocent as ever. I must say I'm glad I had her before you did. Dear Marita, tell me, did David work before he started drinking today?"
"Did you, David?" Marita asked. "I finished a story," David said.
"And I suppose Marita's already read it?"
"Yes, I did."
"You know, I've never read a story of David's. I never interfere. I've only tried to make it economically possible for him to do the best work of which he is capable."
David took a sip of his drink and looked at her. She was the same wonderful, dark, and beautiful girl as ever, and the ivory white hair was like a scar across her forehead. Only her eyes had changed, and her lips, that were saying things they were incapable of saying.
"I thought it was a very good story," Marita said. "It was strange, and how do you say, pastoral? Then it became terrible in a way I could not explain. I thought it was magnifique."
"Well," Catherine said, "we all speak French, you know. He might have made the whole emotional outburst in French."
"I was deeply moved by this story," Marita said.
"Because David wrote it, or because it really is first rate?"
"Both,"
the girl said.
"Well," Catherine said, "is there any reason then why I can't read this extraordinary story? I did put up the money for it."
"You did what?" David asked.
"Perhaps not exactly. You did have $1,500 when you married me, and that book about all the mad flyers has sold, hasn't it? You never tell me how much. But I did put up a substantial sum, and you must admit you've lived more comfortably than you did before you married me."
The girl did not say anything, and David watched the waiter setting the table on the terrace. He looked at his watch. It was about 20 minutes before the time they usually had lunch.
I'd like to go in and clean up if I may, he said.
Don't be so bloody false polite, Catherine said. Why can't I read the story?
It's just written in pencil. It hasn't even been copied. You wouldn't want to read it that way.
Marita read it that way.
Read it after lunch, then.
I want to read it now, David.
I really wouldn't read it before lunch.
Is it disgusting?
It's a story about Africa back before the 1914 war, in the time of the Maji Maji War, the native rebellion of 1905 in Tanganyika.
I didn't know you wrote historical novels.
I wish you'd leave it alone, David said. It's a story that happens in Africa when I was about 8 years old.
I want to read it.
David had gone to the far end of the bar and was shaking dice out of a leather cup. The girl sat on a stool next to Catherine. He watched her, watching Catherine as she read.
It starts very well, she said, though your handwriting is atrocious. The country is superb, the passage, what Marita miscalled the pastoral part.
She put down the first notebook and the girl picked it up and held it on her lap, her eyes still watching Catherine. Catherine read on and said nothing now. She was halfway through the second part. Then she tore the cahier in two and threw it on the floor.
It's horrible, she said. It's bestial. So that was what your father was like?
No, said David. But that was one way he was. You didn't finish it.
Nothing would make me finish it.
I didn't want you to read it at all.
No, you both conspired to make me read it. May I have the key, David, to lock it up?
The girl asked. She had retrieved the torn halves of the notebook from the floor. It was just ripped apart. It was not torn across. David gave her his key.
It's even more horrible written in that child's notebook, Catherine said. You're a monster.
It was a very odd rebellion, David said.
You're a very odd person to write about it, she said.
I asked you not to read the story. She was crying now.
I hate you, she said.
They were in their room in bed and it was late.
She'll go away and you'll have me shut up or put away, Catherine said.
No, that isn't true.
But you suggested we go to Switzerland.
If you were worried, we could see a good doctor, the same way we'd go to the dentist.
No, they'd shut me up, I know. Everything that's innocent to us is crazy to them. I know about those places.
It's an easy drive and beautiful. We'd go by Aix and Saint-Rémy and up the Rhone from Lyon to Geneva. We'd see him and get some good advice and make a fun trip out of it.
I won't go.
A very good, intelligent doctor that...
I won't go. Didn't you hear me? I won't go. I won't go. Do you want me to scream?
All right. Don't think about it now. Just try to sleep.
If I don't have to go...
We don't have to.
I'll sleep then. Are you going to work in the morning?
Yes, I might as well.
You'll work well, she said. I know you will. Good night, David. You sleep well, too.
He did not sleep for a long time. When he did, he had dreams of Africa. They were good dreams until the one that woke him. He got up then and went direct from that dream to work. He was well into the new story before the sun came up out of the sea, and he did not look up from where he was to see how red the sun was. In the story, he was waiting for the moon to rise, and he felt his dog's hair rise under his hand as he stroked him to be quiet, and they both watched and listened as the moon came up and gave them shadows. His arm was around the dog's neck now, and he could feel him shivering. All of the night sounds had stopped. They did not hear the elephant, and David did not see him until the dog turned his head and seemed to settle into David. Then the elephant's shadow covered them, and he moved past, making no noise at all, and they smelled him in the light wind that came down from the mountain. He smelled strong but old and sour, and when he was past, David saw that the left tusk was so long it seemed to reach the ground. They waited, but no other elephants came by, and then David and the dog started off running in the moonlight. The dog kept close behind him, and when David stopped, the dog pressed his muzzle into the back of his knee. David had to see the bull again, and they came up on him at the edge of the forest. He was traveling toward the mountain and slowly now moving into the steady night breeze. David came close enough to see him cut off the moon again and to smell the sour oldness, but he could not see the right tusk. He was afraid to work closer with the dog, and he took him back with the wind and pushed him down against the base of the tree and tried to make him understand. He thought the dog would stay, and he did, but when David moved up toward the bulk of the elephant again, he felt the wet muzzle against the hollow of his knee. The two of them followed the elephant until he came to an opening in the trees. He stood there moving his huge ears. His bulk was in the shadow, but the moon would be on his head. David reached behind him and closed the dog's jaws gently with his hand, and then moved softly and unbreathing to his right along the edge of the night breeze, feeling it on his cheek, edging with it, never letting it get between him and the bulk until he could see the elephant's head and the great ears slowly moving. The right tusk was as thick as his own thigh, and it curved down almost to the ground. He and the dog moved back, the wind on his neck now, and they backtracked out of the forest and into the open park country. The dog was ahead of him now, and he stopped where David had left the two hunting spears by the trail when they had followed the elephant. He swung them over his shoulder in their thong and leather cup harness, and, with his best spear that he had kept with him all the time in his hand, they started on the trail for the Shamba. The moon was high now, and he wondered why there was no drumming from the Shamba. Something was strange if his father was there and there was no drumming.
This ends Disc 4.